When the tape ended, we were talking about President Hardin's experience in the Horton Center.
And I wanted to be sure that in saying some things he didn't do, I wanted to be sure to put in one of the important things that he did. He also got the athletic program off on track, and in the year he was here, I think we won baseball, basketball, football, and maybe hockey.
So after some of the scandals or the difficulties in the athletic recruitment, that sort of thing, of the Wharton years, Hardin, you saw some changes in that area?
And got that cleaned up, new coach, new director of athletics, and so on. So he did those things very well. Mm-hmm. Now, you're talking about Cecil Mackey. Cecil Mackey, in a sense, was brought in to follow on Ed Hardin, who hadn't done things, didn't want to make those tough decisions. Mm-hmm. Well, the one virtue of Cecil Mackey is that he had a reputation as president of being able to make the tough decision. Cecil is trained in the law, which is an adversarial approach to problem solving. And so adversarial approaches is just old hat to him. Mm-hmm. He recognized there'd be very, very different ideas, and that didn't bother him. Fine, we don't agree on that, but this is the way it's going to be. And I think he was probably, of all of the presidents I worked with, the individual with the greatest capacity to handle a complex array of facts in a situation, and understand how you had dealt with those, and to, in a sense, judge equity in the handling of different interests and so on. He's very skillful at that. Delegated authority would leave you to do it, but if you went and asked him an opinion, you damn well better have all of your facts, because he wanted to know everything about it. Mm-hmm. So you didn't go there when you were beginning to think about a problem. You went there and talked to him after you had it all solved.
So he was supportive of his administrators?
When Ed Hardin left, he made some recommendations about who to replace and so on, and there was a problem with the student area because we'd just come out of the long student period, and of course all of those guys had accumulated all of the used up social capital. So they replaced all of the student, mm-hmm. all of the student leadership, and Cecil brought in Moses Turner, first black vice president that we had, and very good man. He was did a very good job. He eventually was replaced, having used up his social capital.
In one of the things in the sesquicentennial and dealing with really the 50 years since the last Madison Kuhn's publication of the first 100-year history, in looking at the last 25 years in particular, especially in these good economic times, it's sometimes hard for people to look back at not so long ago when the university was in some tough straits. Could you talk a little bit about how it affected and so the early 80s, obviously, at the time that Dr. Mackey was here, were really tough times. I was a graduate student at that time, so I remember some of it, but could you talk a little, as administrator, how the money crunch specifically affected the university?
Yeah, well, it was really bad. We assumed that we needed to get about 15% cut in our costs in order to have enough flexibility to handle new opportunities and that sort of thing, because we had absolutely no new initiative money. We had to go off campus to get initiative money. Mm-hmm. And the question came, we started kind of at the grassroots and ask all of the departments, how would you take a 15% cut? And when you allow that to happen, you get what you'd anticipate. they figured out, how now could I phrase this so that the administrators clearly would not ever cut this? So they'd get the highest priority and so on, and all their turkeys, which they didn't want to identify, mm-hmm. were left totally unarticulated. Mm-hmm. So that then became a problem for the provost working with the president and since I was the former provost by then, because I had just stepped over to vice president for research, mm-hmm. It was possible for me, along with Lee Winder, who inherited the provost. Well, Larry Boger and Lee Winder working as a team, because I had appointed Winder. Mm-hmm. They were as a team, and now I could support them absolutely because I knew all the numbers, mm-hmm. knew the people, knew the program. I'd been involved in rating the quality of the programs and so on. And so the three of us then could present to Mackey a pretty solid discussion about why the proposals were absolutely not the way you should take a cut. You should actually cut some programs. Well, cutting programs is a way you could terminate faculty, because 80% or more than 80% of the total academic budget is in people. As you can tell by the level of support you get in this place, there's mm-hmm. not much else there. Mm-hmm. You've got your salary, and mm-hmm. you damn well better scrounge for whatever else you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And so what we're saying is that we ought to have a lot more in the way of support for the people you have. You got too many people. So since the people are not without students, if you're going to cut programs, you're going to cut students. So now you've got to pay attention to what the state needs. And so there was essentially a three-tiered process that we had to go through. First was to get proposals from the deans, many of which, not all, but many of which were totally unworkable because they were managing it from their perspective, not from the university's perspective. And they were oftentimes trying to protect little scroungy graduate programs that were non-competitive nationally or even in regionally. Mm-hmm. And some of those should be terminated because there was no enrollment in them to speak of. Mm-hmm. And getting those things out of some departments is pretty traumatic.
Mm-hmm. Were there any in particular of the fights for programs that were really...
Oh,
the one came to the forefront.
The one that rings a bell with me was metallurgy.
Okay.
In engineering, metallurgy in engineering, we only had about I think 10 or 15, maybe 20 undergraduate students in it. We had a graduate program in metallurgy, which was pretty good, but the Michigan Tech had a giant program in undergraduate metallurgy because they had a very good program there related to mining and that sort of thing. And when we suggested terminating that, the mom and pop metal industries of Michigan got together and came in, talked to the legislature, talked to the trustees, and we had a hell of a time. And we ended up not terminating it that year, but phasing it out. So we phased it out over a 2 or 3 year period, but we did terminate. Mm-hmm. That was a toughie. Also, we were going to terminate one of the nursing programs, and let's see, what was the other one? One of the human ecology programs, which was very small. And those were women's programs right at the time the women's movement was just getting underway. Mm-hmm. The trustees would have none of that. And urban affairs, which was the point of black programming, also we had suggested phasing out, and we did in fact phase out one of the programs there. So yeah, that was.
Were there any successes in terms of your position as vice president for research? Were there any successes right at that time where we got more money from Washington, or had the well dried up there, or
No,
the Michigan well that was almost dry.
Yeah. No, we did very well in a couple of areas. One, the one that I'm proudest of, is we built this material science program, and I started on that when I was talking about Jack Kinsinger back there.
Okay, that's right.
Jack came in, and he had told me when he was chairman of chemistry that we really, in this state, there wasn't a substantial program in material science. Ann Arbor didn't have it. Michigan Tech didn't have it. Wayne didn't have it. So we had an opportunity here, because this is a manufacturing state, to really get into some aspect of material science. And so we had earlier, in Hannah's time, put together a science development program beefing up the departments of chemistry, physics, and mathematics. This goes all the way back to Hannah's last 2 years. And I had continued getting the necessary matching dollars that we were required by our agreement to come up and keep that going while I was provost. And so we said, all right, we have to now look at what aspect of chemistry, physics, and mathematics, because we can't cover the breadth of any one of those three fields. Let's focus on the material science contributions of those three. So Jack Kinsinger and I put together what we wanted to do, went to Washington, got some support for further development in the science development program on those aspects of it. We eventually got the state of Michigan. Remember, there was the three institutes which the state started, research institutes. One was the... let's see, what do they call that damn thing? Down at University of Michigan. It was focused on automated engineering, computerizing engineering. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm trying to think of what the name of it was.
I don't know.
It's in my thing there. You'll see it in my opus. But anyway, they got that first. And then the second one was supposed to be based in the broad area of agriculture, which was Michigan's second largest, manufacturing first, agriculture second. And so Ann Arbor and Michigan State and Wayne all put in proposals to site a center in some area of biology. Well, Ann Arbor wanted to have a protein center, which is a good choice because a lot of things are coming out in protein chemistry now. We said, no, what we really need is a center that would focus on making commercial products from agricultural surpluses. Get focused in that area. And so the Michigan Biological Institute, MBI, which is out here on College Road. Are you familiar
with it? Yes, right by the post office.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. MBI, we won that in a shootout with Ann Arbor and Wayne. And then the third one was in material science, and that came along much later. And Michigan State worked a deal to support siting it up at Midland, where you have a lot of material science capability. And Central Michigan got involved in it, and we got involved in it, and we built a center for material science here, which I finally got a building built, and that's another story I have to tell you. The building that's out behind Baker Woodlot, mm-hmm. and behind the clinic center, that engineering facility back there. Mm-hmm. Well, I had wanted to put an extension on the engineering building, which they have now done, by the way. What I wanted to do was to do it in cheap construction, mm-hmm. steel and so on. And here the athletic department had just put this giant practice field, or had gotten the plans to get this giant practice thing out here on what's the name of the road going through here?
Shaw
Lane. And Ted Stevens, who was head of physical plant at the time, vice president for, assistant vice president, I guess it is, for physical plant, absolutely not. He'd been through the Quonset area on this campus, and they become giant money sumps where you can't afford to heat them or light them, and you have to repair them, and they just eat up your maintenance budget. Can't afford that. Not going to have any temporary buildings. Well, why the hell is athletics got it? Well, I couldn't win that battle. So I finally said, well, we got to have it because we got to get a place where this thing can go on, and we can't have it in the existing engineering building. It's going to be too noisy and so on. So, well, all right. Finally, Ted retired, and his replacement, Tom, anyway, Ted's replacement, head of materials, head of
physical plant,
yeah. Anyway, I finally persuaded him, well, we'll hide it. We'll put it behind the clinic center, behind the wood lot over there. Nobody will ever see it. But in scientific structures, it costs more to modernize an existing building than it does to tear it down and build new. Mm-hmm. And scientific research requirements are moving so fast in terms of safety issues, communication issues, power demands, and so on, and the need to consolidate all of these things, very expensive equipment. You cannot build these big expensive buildings and keep building that. It just doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Build a building that you can razz and start over and redesign it for the new concept. Okay, well, I finally persuaded him, so that's how we got that building out there. And lots of parking.
Which is a premium. That's
absolutely. Well, let's see, where were we? We were
talking about the material science.
Oh, material science. Well, eventually we got this center, this institute, located at Midland. And now we got a material science institute out in this new building. And then we got a big grant here just after I retired, as a matter of fact, from Dow Chemical Company, partly because of our support for getting that up there, for building this broader. So Michigan State really is the material science presence in this state. Mm-hmm. And in particular, they're in the plastics more than in the exotic mineral end. You get places like MIT or
Cal. Is Michigan Tech involved in that at all, or not? Not
no,
you don't think so?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We go back to discussion of the presidents, and then your work was John DiBiagio, the last president you worked with.
Yes.
Or okay. Yeah. Would you talk a little bit about, or maybe go back to Dr. Mackey's leaving? Obviously, he's still at the university, but
yeah. Well, Mackey had a number of things. As a person trained in the adversarial area, he didn't mind an occasional argument. He had to solve two problems. He had to make the budget cuts that were extremely unpopular and irritated a whole number of constituencies around the state, the women's group, the black group, the metal group. He had the addition of the new problem in athletics, athletic recruiting problem came along. And then came the alumni organization that had been free and on its own. And Cecil took the extremely gutty job of just absolutely withdrawing all of the resources from that group, mm-hmm. firing the director and the head of their publications, just cleaned them right out. That, and they had created alumni groups all over the United States. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you now get all of that coming into the Board of Trustees, and clearly he had used up his social capital, but he had mm-hmm. done an absolutely essential thing mm-hmm. for this university.
Made the tough decisions.
And made the tough decisions, and he is very good. He's as good an administrator, willing to make the gutty kind of decisions of any of the presidents I ever worked with. He and John Hanna. John Hanna had that ability too, but he had it at a time when he had the backing of the board. Mm-hmm. Cecil had to make it when we did not have a management board. Mm-hmm. We had a board that had its own agenda.
Mm-hmm. In the last president that you worked with, Dr. DiBiagio.
Dr. DiBiagio, mm-hmm. John DiBiagio. It's interesting. Just kind of, it's a gross oversimplification, but there's an element of truth in it. Cecil was the fighter and enjoyed it. He liked to take on tough jobs and solve it. And he didn't, it doesn't bother him that a lot of people take umbrage at it. John DiBiagio was the lover. John was a warm, just an absolutely delightful human being. And I enjoyed working with both of them. I found both of them absolutely first-rate guys. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I didn't have a criticism of any of the presidents. You know, individual decisions I disagreed with. But in terms of their overall thing, I think universities typically recruit presidents who are the antithesis of what the current president is. If you think about John Hanna, he ran the university the way old land-grant universities were run. Mm-hmm. A president who had both the authority and the responsibility to run the damn place. And he had a supporting board before the Constitutional Convention. The Senate of Michigan was run by rural Michigan. The rural Michigan politicians came up through cooperative extension. Mm-hmm. These were people out there that we had a political constituency was absolutely ideal. It was a perfect. And so he did very well in that period. Then when he got this new board, which was elected, and with the political dynamics of Michigan, with the unions so powerful in the nominating process, they actually unseated in subsequent elections members of the board that did not vote the way the union wanted. Mm-hmm. So it's very real politics. And so if you take Hanna now with the kind of decisions he makes, then they brought in Walter Adams, who was almost the antithesis of that. Mm-hmm. Adams was a liberal, pro-labor, kind of anti big corporations. So, you know, he saw a lot of his academic work. Good man. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed working with him. But just totally different. So he's the antithesis of Hanna. Then you bring in Cliff Wharton, who in a sense was a very different thing. This almost was a case where they wanted to get back to an agriculturally focused guy. Mm-hmm. And he had his degree in ag economics. Mm-hmm. And he had been in international programs over in Malaysia and so on, had been with the Rockefeller Foundation, understood all of that. So they brought him in. You see, very different from Walter. Then you brought in, as an interim, you brought in Ed Hardin, who, in a sense, didn't make any solutions. So they now bring in Cecil Mackey to make all the tough decisions that Ed Hardin didn't. After he's now alienated a wide thing, they have to go into fundraising. They don't want Cecil Mackey representing the university in fundraising because he's irritated all a number of people out here.
Hat in hand, had to go to the alumni. Yeah. Wasn't going to work.
You're right. So they bring in the lover, John DiBiagio, who had done great work in Connecticut where he had been. And he, again, was an excellent president for that period. And made an absolutely fantastic fundraising thing, and way over, got way over the prospect.
The in going up to the president, how would you characterize President McPherson?
Ideal,
for the times.
For the times, we needed to have a solid financial person who understands the fiscal nature of Michigan State University. We also need to get back the kind of international thing that Hanna epitomized. Hannah, remember, after he left here, headed up USAID.
Mm-hmm.
And he built and thought about the role of the land grant concept enabling people. See, that's the guts of the land grant idea. You design a system to create knowledge, to dispense knowledge, skills, and so on, to enable people to succeed. That's the land grant magic. And so if you think about developing countries, that's absolutely what's needed. And I've made this observation a number of times. That idea of enabling people in the kind of repressive governments that exist around the world is very destabilizing.
Mm-hmm.
So, because you're enabling those guys out there to get along without you. And by God.
A revolutionary concept.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you look at the places we've had, there have been revolutions following us. The mm-hmm. biggest one and the most dramatic one is Nigeria.
Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it started at Nsukka, mm-hmm. which we created.
Uh-huh.
That was an interesting thing. Mm-hmm. There's a little vignette in my thing there that you...
on Nigeria.
Yeah, on Nigeria. We won't go into the details. But.
And so the President McPherson's experience in AID also.
AID, mm-hmm. and the fact that he's a solid money man, understands all of the financing, has credibility with the business mm-hmm. and industry community since he comes out of the banking area,
mm-hmm.
grew up on a farm, he's a Michigan native, believes deeply in the land grant approach.
Mm-hmm. And alumnus.
And an alum. Mm-hmm. And so... Absolutely. Every one of the presidents, I like the way the succession has taken place. It's perfect for the time that we're in. We've been very, very lucky.
The in talking about some of your own research, Did you were you involved in teaching at all after you were and became an administrator? Or no?
I tried for a short while, but uh-huh. there was the middle of the student unrest.
Okay.
And I missed 3 PhD exams because I insisted that I would take no more than 4 graduate students
mm-hmm.
to supervise their theses. And that's the maximum I allowed myself. But I served on 60 other graduate committees
mm-hmm.
because of my interdisciplinary interests. Agriculture, a number of the departments there, and human ecology, and in natural science, entomology, and zoology.
So even as administrator, you were and provost, you were sought out as to serve on committees.
Right, and I stopped accepting those assignments after I had missed, because that's a very critical part, as you know from your own thing, to have a person who been and writing and going over theses. I can't edit unless I edit.
Yeah.
And I edit with a heavy pencil.
When I wrote my dissertation, Fred Williams had just taken on the faculty grievance officer. So I gave him the chapters, and I know he was really busy.
Oh yeah.
So I understand that. I experienced it.
I gave it up, and when Cecil came on, he said he would like to have all of the administrators, you know, continue with some kind of faculty appointment. And I said, well. You know, I only have a little bit of time left. No, I guess that was when John DiBiagio came in. But anyway, I did lecture,
mm-hmm.
occasional lectures in entomology and zoology and botany.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with a number of, human ecology. I worked very hard getting the name change of that college.
Oh, you did?
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah.
Okay.
B. Pellucci and I had served together on the Educational Policies Committee, so we were colleagues. And she had been interested in the household as an input-output system. And of course, that's one of the key aspects of ecology. dealing with a community or an area as an input-output system. And so when I was at NSF, I met with her back on campus and talked about it. And then when I got back on campus, I helped bring about that change.
Mm-hmm. Was that change completed before Lois Lund became dean? Or?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
All right, so that was...
And I'd have to say, and I don't wouldn't want you to write this, but I Lois Lund was not the best choice for continuing that because she was too much in the groove of old human ecology, which is kind of women's studies.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that's not what the opportunity was. The opportunity was really to do human ecology. And I talked to national groups, gave a number of speeches talking about, if you think about trying to get at the key problems, family problems, sets of environmental problems, and housing, homeless, all of those, they've got essentially the mandate to do that. Furthermore, they've got a deployed system of cooperative extension agents out there in all of the key county offices around the state.
Mm-hmm.
So, A, they have the disciplines, they have access to all of the basic disciplines here on the campus, they have a delivery system out there, why not put it to work to do the right thing? And if you could start that going, then tapping into the new funding. Well, it turns out that the dynamic